Welcome to Dead Pilot Society, the show that takes comedy pilots from A-list writers that were sold and developed at networks and streamers but never produced, and gives them the table reads they never got a chance to have. I'm Andrew Reich, the creator and host of Dead Pilot Society, and this is the after show for Kings of Ohio, featuring my interview with Kat Lickle and John Hoberg. There was so much to talk about with these two. They've worked on so many interesting shows. My Name is Earl, Better Off Ted, The Neighbors, Downward Dog, Gallivant. They've really worked on some of the most interesting, unconventional network comedies of the last couple of decades. And we talk about most of those shows and their upcoming Pixar film, Elemental. There's lots of great insider info about the Pixar process here. We also talk about Kat's very unusual road into TV writing and, of course, their goats. Kat and John, you know, these are veterans who are always finding ways to push their craft in interesting new directions, and you just won't find anyone with a bad word to say about these two, and believe me, I have tried. So enjoy my interview with Kat Lickle and John Hoberg after a brief message.
I'm glad you said that, because nobody says that.
Can I just say thank you to you for such a thoughtful interview?
Oh my God, yeah, I think you nailed it.
Bullseye. Interviews with creators you love and creators you need to know. Listen to the Bullseye podcast only from NPR and Maximum Fun.
Kat and John, there's some goat issues that prevented us from doing this earlier, correct?
There were goat issues, yes.
Which is an excuse I don't get a lot.
Yeah. It was actually Tom Brady, though. That's the crazy thing. It wasn't like the type of goat.
Oh, okay. What's the story with your goats, just out of curiosity? How many goats do you have? Where are the goats?
We have six. We have six goats.
Up in Solvang.
In Solvang.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The whole thing started so because we have a, I don't know, like 3 or 4 acre field, and the grass grows, and after the rains, you know, it grows up like waist high, but it gets so dried out that when you mow it, if the blade hits a rock, it could start the whole, like a spark could set the whole thing on fire. And, you know, we weren't going to mow it because that's a big field, but there's a guy who mows those fields, but he'll only do it when there's like a misty morning. And then everyone in the valley calls for him. And so we were at the beginning of the pandemic, we were driving by the park and there was a herd of goats just eating all the grass down. And we're like, oh, cool. And so I called just around, like, where, how do you rent goats? Right. And I found people who do it, but they won't rent for any field smaller than 20 acres because it's not worth their time. And then this one guy was like, just buy goats. They're like $60 each. So we're like, where do you buy goats? And he's like, Craigslist. So
we saved a little sketch.
You had to go to the like couple seeking goats section, which is
exactly. Okay. It was a little nerve wracking what we were going to find. Yeah, but we found this. It was this woman, Cassidy, and she and her husband did that LA thing I think people dream of, which is like, let's just sell everything and start a farm somewhere. Like, I feel like at a certain point in your life, people have that ambition. Sure. And they did it. They were like academics and like, I don't know what they were, marine biologists?
Marine biologists, yeah.
And then they made some deal where I think, what was it, Cassidy? Because they don't like all the killing that came with the farming, but they like the sustainable farming. And so Cassidy made some deal with her husband that if she could sell the goats that she thought had the most personality to people instead of killing them, you know, as long as they made back whatever their investment was, she would do that. So we got six of the most interesting goats, according to Cassidy.
And so, but you guys don't live, so you have a place in Solvang, and but that's not where you are most of the time, or is it? Like, where do you spend your time?
How
do you
kind of split 60-40, probably 40 up there, 60 down here? It kind of depends on where we're working or, you know, what's going on. Cause like John is working, or was until the pandemic, I was working at Paramount and I'm at home writing a book, so I can be wherever I need to be. John needs to be close to Paramount. So it's like, so we tend to be down, you know, 60% here, 40% up there probably.
Yeah. And sometimes we'll be there for a couple of weeks or, you know, I don't know. It's, there's no plan. We have no life plan. It's just happening.
But you've got those, 14 children that it says you have on IMDb. Yes.
Yeah, that was just screwing around and seeing what you could get away with. On, I think I put down that I majored in whistling and spelling also. That, I think that's what we're in showbiz for, is just to sort of push the boundaries of what
Do you remember your IMDb bio? Well, speaking of that, we should say you guys have a Pixar movie coming out, which is incredible. I mean, coming out in June?
Yeah.
June
16th.
Yeah.
Wow. This is so, all right, there's so much to talk about, but because that is just like so imminent, can we talk a little bit? It's called Elemental.
Yes.
And just tell me everything. Tell me how that came about and a little bit about that Pixar experience.
It came, you know, I think John and I have talked about this. I think Pixar is in some way like the CIA. You don't call them, they call you. And so a couple of years ago, I guess it's been 3.5 years ago, maybe almost four.
We were 2019.
Yes, we were at the Austin Film Festival. And we got a phone call out of the blue that somebody from Pixar would like to meet with us. And we're like, okay. You know, and we have, our friend Dan Fogelman has worked for Pixar. And, you know, we thought, well, maybe Dan gave them our name or something. I don't know. So we sat and had a meeting with them. And it was this woman, Mary Coleman, who's now moved on to a different company, but she was awesome. And it was just this fun meeting about who we are, what we write. She did hear about us initially from Dan and then forgot about us.
In 2012, she'd heard about us.
She'd heard about us in 2012, forgot about us for the next 6 years. And then saw our names on a list that we were at the festival. And so she came.
And what were you at the festival with?
We had sold a pitch for a feature, a country music musical with this guy, producer Matt Gross. And it was one of those rare like things. It was the perfect experience of our life as far as pitching goes, where we went out with musicians and Matt Gross and hit all the studios. I think it was like, 7 or 8 studios in 3 days or something, and just pitched it. And like our first pitch was at Paramount, and we got an offer. We were told we're getting an offer while we're waiting at the valet. The next was at like Lucasfilm. And then the woman's like, where are you in the process? Right afterward. And Matt was like, I'm going to be honest with you. We just had, you're our second pitch and we already have one offer. She goes, well, you're getting another one. And we ended up getting like 6 studios. This never happened to us. Bidding on this thing, and it became this bidding war. And that is so unusual with a feature pitch that they, Matt had talked to someone at the Austin Film Festival, and they were like, can you do a panel about that? So we did. It was just such a random thing. We were even there.
It's like, because we got on the panel like that. Okay, you were the last people this is ever going to happen to. Can you tell the rest of us what it was like?
My lawyer was like, this is fucking crazy. Like, it's like the 90s with this project. I don't know what's going on. And then before you ask, it's, you know, it's in turnaround and we'll never get out of Paramount because it costs so much. Yeah. And no one would pay the money to take it away.
Everybody liked the script. It looked like everything was going great. And then there was like a house cleaning at Paramount. Yeah. So everybody we had worked with was fired.
Well, in addition, there was, and then it was the pandemic, and then they were just not doing, you know,
anything.
$15 million. Country musicals anymore.
But I guess in some way, I mean, so it brings you to this festival, which reminds this Pixar person of your existence. And so it kind of leads to, all right.
I feel like that's how
it all paid off. It was like a circle that, you know, took us. It's like, you never know where the path is going to take you when you're in this business.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of got to follow it. And
you have this meeting at Pixar Do they have this idea or do you bring them? Okay, so what happens next? Do you have this meeting?
Well, we have the meeting and then they basically, they're like, we're big fans of, they read everything. Like they had a stack of almost everything we ever wrote, you know? And so that's when we sat down for coffee and we're like, oh, they're serious about this. We kind of thought it might be one of those sort of meet and greets that never goes anywhere. And then they told us like, look, if something feels appropriate for you guys, we'll let you know, but heads up, it could be years from now, or it could be tomorrow. We just don't know. And so we kind of put it out of our heads. And then we got a call I think directly from Mary. I think she, yeah, her manager was like, just call them. And she's like, hey, I think there's a project that's looking for a new writer. There'd been a writer there who had done two versions. And then, you know, she was gone. And they're like, we want you to come up and meet this director. And this was only like 3 weeks later. And so we're like, okay, great. And then basically they sent a car in the morning. You get, you know, you go to the airport, you're at Pixar by lunch. We had lunch with the director for about an hour and a half, Pete Sohn, who we fell in love with instantly. Like,
adored.
He's
adored.
Really, yeah, he is brilliant and sweet. And just like, you know, those people you meet in showbiz, you're like, okay, I hope this works out. And we were home by like 4:30 or 5 that day. And sort of in this, like, did that even happen? We had to sign non-disclosure stuff. They didn't even tell us what the movie was about when we had the meeting. We just, looking back, Pete was really interviewing us with the right questions, but we had no idea what the movie was about. And then, you know, they go through and we talked to Fogelman and he's like, just know they're going to meet a dozen people. They meet a dozen people. So also don't think that that's maybe a done deal. And then we ended up getting the job.
And also, by the way, with Pixar, a sudden need for a new writer is not unusual for them. It's really unusual that one writer completes a movie. It's like we always joke, and it's a little nicer than this, but we always joke that for them, writers are like toner cartridges. And it's like, the ink's getting a little light. If there's anything in here, all right, we'll find a new one.
Yep, we've sucked all the ink out of this one. Let's go to the next one. But it, I mean, and they're very upfront about that. It's like, that's part of the, you know, yeah, it's a director driven place and that's the one constant, and the writers, you know, the way to definitely not stick around at Pixar is to dig your heels in and say, no, I think this is the way it should be, which, you know, every time I've heard of people leaving, often there's something in that or it's just not a match.
And by the way, I think one of the reasons that we worked, or we meshed well with Pixar is because, you know, we grew up in television writing where you do version after version after version. You're getting notes. You're getting notes from your executive. You're getting notes from the studios. You're getting all of these things. And so then you're getting notes on set. You know, there's things that you need to be able to change on the fly. So I think television writing, you become extremely flexible. And that really benefited us with going into the Pixar process. So we could constantly be flexible with them. We never were like, no, this is the version. This is the one we're doing now. You know,
it's kind of like being, this is going to sound like too lofty, but like second in command on a show, like you're chasing a showrunner's vision. And in this case, it's a director. And then you also, there is kind of a staff of writers called the story team. And they're the storyboard artists, but they also contribute to the story. So it's a fantastic, unusual process there that, you know, it either works for you or it doesn't. And some people's brilliant writers have come and gone like that. And, you know, others have stayed. So.
But once you guys were brought on, you kind of stuck it through to the.
Yeah.
To the end.
We got to the end. We got lucky in that way. We just meshed with the team and it. And we totally bought into what, you know, Pete wanted to do with this movie. And then they do this thing, they call it the iterative process. So you basically make the movie every 3 months, hand-drawn, and then you have temporary voice actors at the beginning who are, you know, like the security guard and someone in animation are like reading the lines. And then they sweeten it and, you know, and do sound effects and everything. And then you show this movie to what's called the Brain Trust. And, you know, for us, it was a whole bunch of different directors, but Andrew Stanton was there, who's like a god in our minds, and Pete Docter, who is also, and you're getting direct feedback on this 3 month movie that's all hand drawn with the security guard or whoever's doing the voice. And it's just very honest feedback. And, you know, a lot of times you'll walk out of those and like, oof, boy, that didn't go over well, but we got a nugget that works. And then you kind of get the smoldering remains and then like, okay, what worked, what didn't, throw everything else out and let's build it again.
And so what was fun, just briefly, the guy who did the male lead voice, a guy named Wade, We never met him in person. We only ever saw him on the screen.
He was really good, by the way.
He was really good at it. But he's always this big on the screen, and his name's Jake, and we would always have this fun back and forth. And he's, you know, I don't remember exactly what it is that he does at Pixar. He's not an animator, but he's in the technology part of it somehow. In any case, when we went up there for the rap party, we all of a sudden heard this familiar voice, but we're like, that's Original Wade. And then we turned around and Jake walked towards us. And I swear to God, he was almost like 7 feet tall. And we're like, holy crap, you looked a lot smaller on screen. He's like, I know. And it's just like, it enfolded both of us in this giant bear hug. But it was like,
I freak people out all the time with that.
So what do you think you'll carry with you from that process into your next thing that you guys write?
You know, I know what I think.
I know what I think. You say yours and I'll say mine.
I used to loathe rewrites, like notes, right? And you would get notes and you're like, ugh, and a lot of times. And then you're like, oh God, I have to rewrite this thing. And holding on, whether you realize it or not, you're being precious about a joke or a scene or something. And the amount of rewriting we had to do, I think I looked up at the file cat the other day, and sequences, the number of sequences, which is multiple scenes saved in the file of all the writing we did on this movie. We did 8 versions, by the way. I think there were like 870 saved file sequences. I mean, it's kind of a different movie every time, but we're in a constant state of rewriting. And we kind of figured out this trick that we're going to continue with, I think. And that's that it's like when they try to communicate the artist, they'll be like, and then they'll quickly sketch something and show you it, right? What we realize is our power is after multi-cams and all this, you've learned to write fast and at least at a good level, not your best. That takes a little more time. But we could get ideas across to try them out and be like, you know what? Give us 20 minutes and we'd write a scene. And come back, we're like, if you like it, we can make it really good. But this is what we're thinking. And that's changed how we're writing now, because that's how we approach it.
Yeah, It's taught us both, or me. I tend to be, or tended to be, a much more precious writer. Like, no, this sentence can't get any better. It's like, what, are you crazy? And it's just like, and that has really changed. It's like the knowledge that you have as a writer, as a creative person, there's always another one. There's always another one. You don't have to hold on. You'll find that next thing. You just need to believe that you will. You know, when you make it, it's like when Pete would sometimes, he'd say, well, we're going to axe that scene and we're going to need to do that. You'd just be like, and you'd have to sit and remember, there's another one. There's always another one. That's the magic about what we do as writers. It's like, you know, you can always pull something else out of the air.
Yeah. If you can keep that, if you can carry that with you and keep that, like, that's the greatest gift, right? Because, you know, and I always wonder how much of the preciousness is laziness. You know, it's just like, I'm hanging on to this because I just don't feel like writing another thing. It doesn't mean this is great. It's just like, I just don't want to. But I guess when you can have that, you know, and you fall into it, sometimes you have the attitude of, you know what, let me just make it better. I'll take another swing. This is cool. Yeah. Like,
I think we also tend to fall in love with language sometimes. Like, no, that was a perfectly crafted sentence. Listen, right? Just flowed like poetry. It's like, let it flow on out. You'll find another one.
Yeah, I think it's also with, it kind of unlocked this thing for me that I feel like there's this problem where you write and you're almost picturing it going on screen as you're writing it, instead of, even though we all know the process in television, it's like, you're going to write that draft. There's going to be punch up. There's punch up on set. There's changes in edit, but still, when we're writing, we're putting all this, like, the world is looking over our shoulders as we write it, it's on screen. And this really just got rid of that thinking at all, because you're like, this is the best that we're all as a group going to be able to do in a 3-month period to make this next screening as good as it can be. It's not what's going to be in the final movie. And in a lot of ways, it reminded me, and I think Kat, we talked about this, that it's like, what you're writing isn't going directly to press or write on screen. So take the pressure off a little bit. So,
yeah. All right. So that's the most recent, you know, let's go back to how you guys started, because you didn't start out writing together. And am I right that Kat, did you start
first? I did.
And so which one of you is from Ohio and who's from Ohio, who's from Kansas?
Ohio.
Okay, Kansas. John. Okay. All right. So I don't know. Let's start with you, Kat. So Kansas, and where in Kansas?
A little teeny tiny town called Colby, Kansas. It's the only thing it's famous for is a John Denver song where there's the line born just south of Colby, Kansas in the song. It's the only thing anybody ever knows Colby for.
Okay. And then how do you get into television writing from Colby, Kansas?
I think from the time I was little, I loved writing. I would get in trouble at school for not doing the English assignment I was supposed to do, but you know, just writing stuff, you know, poems or little short stories and stuff. And I remember during math class, algebra class, anything past 2 + 2, it's like, I need fingers and toes and John to tell me what it is. And I was ignoring my math work that I was supposed to be doing. And instead, I think I was writing a poem and my algebra teacher came by and looked at it and she went, that's really nice. But I need you to do the formulas from the board. You can do this later. So, and I failed math. I had to take it twice. And I just barely, I think she took pity on me the second time. But that was, it's just like, don't know where it came from. I don't come from an enormously creative family. I come from a family of farmers and on one side and painters, as in house painting and construction on the other side. And so I'm a little bit of an outlier.
But you got to act originally.
Oh, I did. That's too embarrassing.
I know you don't like talking about that.
No, I did. I went to college as a, and I dropped out of college as a theater major. And I ended up moving to LA thinking it was going to be like, now people are dying for somebody like me. And they might have been dying for somebody like me, but who could act?
Just that little detail.
That was the little problem. And there was a certain point where I recognized it. I had to realize it wasn't like every auditioner that was looking at me was stupid. I was like, maybe
being the best actress in Colby, Kansas isn't quite enough to make it in Hollywood.
They'd never seen acting in Colby before.
I was the lead in Shoemaker and the Elves, in junior high, but that didn't, translate. So I stopped acting and it was a real shakeup. I had no idea what I was going to do. It had been everything that I wanted. And this was around the time when the AIDS crisis was really at its height. And my mom is a nurse. My stepfather is a doctor. My dad was a social worker. So I had sort of, I think, a part of that caregiving mentality. And I ended up looking for and getting a job at AIDS Project Los Angeles, which people were still really freaked out about this kind of thing. And I got a job in the legal department doing deathbed wills, like you do. And so the lawyer and I would go off to, it's like we would get a call from somebody. And you got to remember also, this is a time before gay marriage was legal. Families would be very upset about their, gay children and not accepting, not everybody, but it was a lot more, it could get really ugly. And there were a lot of stories where partners who'd been together for 25, 30 years, in committed relationships, and one of them would pass away and the house would be in that person's name. And so then the family would come in, swoop in and say, it's mine, because people didn't think about, right. When you're a 25-year-old guy, you're not expecting to die real fast. So people didn't have wills. So long story short, I worked for a lawyer and then he and I went to deathbeds. We did deathbed wills. And so I ended up talking to a lot of people who were literally within days or hours of dying. And my job was to hold people's hands, and it was men and women, and hold their hands. And because there was always going to be a question, was the will going to be contested? And I was going to be the one called in to testify. This person was cogent when they made the will. So my job was to hold that person's hand, talk to him or her, and then ask them non sequitur questions. Like, have you thought what you're going to do about the dog? You know, who you're going to leave the dog to, or what arrangements you're going to make, knowing full well that maybe that person didn't have a dog. And so if they said, oh, make sure Fifi goes to, you know, my partner, then you've got a problem because they're not cogent
right
necessarily to make a will. So you'd ask a bunch of questions about their life, how old they were, who they were married to, what they're, you know, all these things, so that if I was called in ever to testify at a court of law, I could testify that this person was cogent. So, and what it did, and this is getting back around the
writing. I got to say, at this point, I could not guess the next story beat of how we're getting to television writing. I'm fascinated. Keep going.
This is why we were hired by Pixar. So what happened was I was holding the hand of a lot of people who were also telling me the stories of the thing that they wish they had done that they had never done in their lives. A lot of it. And I went home and started thinking about what do I wish that I had done or tried and it was writing. And it was really, for me, it was all about writing, that I wished that I didn't want to face the end of my life without at least having given it a shot. And that's changed everything for me.
Mm. And so did you start writing TV right away? Did you start writing like TV specs, or was there another kind of writing that you tried first?
I had a ridiculous, I quit my job, they convinced me to go off on kind of a compassionate leave. They're like, this happens to a lot of people, they get burned out. We can give you like 3 months of, you know, like compassionate leave. And while I was in the middle of that 3 months, a friend of mine who was an animation writer for Disney Television, and he and I, you know, were good friends and had talked, and he knew I had this vague interest in writing. And the second he heard I quit, he came to me and he said, I have a job. I'm going to be running like a 3 month long project for Disney Television Animation. And I can hire one writer that I want. Are you interested? And it was literally a couple of weeks after I left APLA. And so it felt like a very, a meant to be moment. And that started off my television writing career. And I worked in television animation. I worked my way from shows you've never heard of up until, you know, Rugrats and, DuckTales and, you know, Chippendales, Rescue Rangers, you know, like all of this other stuff, until I eventually got to, I got to a television show starring Peter Scolari, and it was called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, based on the movie. And, and so that was it. That was my beginning.
And I believe John Hoberg was also a writer on that.
Well, that was nepotism, though, because we had not teamed up at that point.
Oh, okay. All right. In my mind, I'm like, just, you know, trying to glean from the IMDb pages. I'm like, huh, do they meet on that show? All right. So now, Hoberg, John, you're from where in Ohio?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio. And how do you come out to Hollywood?
I went to Skidmore College in upstate New York and had no idea what I was going to do with my life. And so many people were from New York City that they all just kind of went to New York, you know, back to New York after graduation. So I did that. And then I ended up getting a job through a family friend as like an assistant at a book literary agency where I was like reading the slush pile, you know, and just kind of slaving away in book publishing. Still no idea what I thought. Maybe I'd be a book editor. You know, I had a decent eye for the slush pile. I found a couple books that ended up, you know, getting published. But, and one of the, in the slush pile one day was this book by Rob Long called Conversations with My Agent. And he had sold it, I think, in England first before in America. And the agency that he went through, I think, had some kind of reciprocal agreement with the agency I was working at. And so my boss has no interest in television. She's like, read this thing and see what you think. And so I picked it up like when I got on, like as I got on the subway, and I read it straight through to the end. And I was like, holy crap, this is what I want. I want to do it. Just sounded really, I don't think it even crossed my mind you could write television for a living. I don't know what I thought happened. I guess if you really quiz me, I might eventually realize it was written by people. But Rob was coming in to meet, because I told my boss the next day, it's like, yeah, we absolutely should try to sell this. And so Rob was coming through New York, and so I got to meet him, and he was really cool. And I was, you know, I was like 21 or 22, like wearing sweater vests and trying to learn to smoke a pipe so I would look old enough so people would take me seriously in publishing. And Rob showed up in like tennis shoes and a t-shirt, and it's like I think he just finished running Cheers. And he told me more about the business. I was like, this sounds incredible. And then coincidentally, about a month later, Cindy Shupack and Ellen Sandler, do you know those writers?
Mm-hmm.
Like Cindy wrote for Sex and the City. And Ellen, she and Ellen were a team, and they wrote on Raymond. They were going around New York City publishing, because they just sold a pilot. They had an overall deal at Universal or something. And they sold a pilot about a woman who starts a literary agency in her living room. And so they called him again. My boss had no interest, but she's like, if you want to meet with them, they just want information. And so, you know, I feel like I called him back and was like, I'm the lowliest person here. If you want to meet me, I'm happy to do it. And so I met with them, and they were incredible. And they gave me more insight into what it was, and basically told me, like, just because I'd met a guy and we were writing a script together. And they basically offered, if you finish that script, send it to us and we'll be honest and tell you what we think. And so, you know, I wrote a couple specs with this guy, and then we ended up sending him out to Ellen. I think I quit. I kind of do a cat tattoo too. I quit the job as soon as we finished those scripts, and sent them to Ellen and Cindy. And I was like, here we go. And then I basically, the plan was I was going to move back home to Columbus and live in my parents' basement for the 3 weeks it would probably take for Hollywood to say, come out here, because you're famous now. And then, I didn't know it takes a long time for a busy person to read a script. And so I showed up in Columbus. And I've never told them this part, because it would probably make them feel so terrible. But it took them a couple months, and I'm in the basement just like twiddling my thumbs, like, what the hell's going to happen here? I quit my job. And then finally I got a call from Ellen, and she's like, look, the scripts are funny. She's like, the stories are not strong, but the good news is you can't teach funny, but you can teach structure. And she said, if you're ever out in LA, give us a call. You know, we'd love to take you out to lunch or something. And kind of gave some advice on, you know, what to change in the scripts. So I ended up moving out to LA pretty much right away. And then this is the part Kat hates, is I show up in LA and Cindy and Ellen now have a budget for a development assistant. So I literally walk into LA, become an assistant to two people who are going to have their own show. And I was it was the final season of Coach, and I was sitting in the, like they cleared out a copy room right across the hall from Cindy and Ellen's office, but it was in the hallway where all the Coach writers would just stand outside their office and talk script, and they would include me. And it was like a graduate school. It was incredible. And from learning all of that, this partner and I wrote our, you know, our first legit spec, and then ended up getting a job on, it was like a mid-season show with a guy named Barton Dean that had like two backup scripts, and we got one of those backup scripts. So that was my first job ever. It came really fast, and Kat and I had started dating at that point, and I remember she tried not to show how pissed she was when this happened.
In the meantime, I was selling off bits of my furniture piece by piece to pay my rent. John actually bought one of my lamps, because it's like I had a lamp that had belonged to Lucille Ball. We still own it. It had belonged to Lucille Ball. And so that was my magic lamp. And
I was too proud to take money. So I think you needed $200 extra or something. Yeah. And your people didn't just buy something in my apartment, so I bought the lamp.
And that's at a point where you'd already been working, right, on these animated shows and Disney shows, but you're still like...
Animation, it turns out television animation doesn't pay a lot of money. And there's no residuals or anything like that. There's no WGA for animation writers. And so that was as I was... like fighting over the I bought the lamp back from John eventually. It's still sitting in the living room. But that was my big lesson. It's like I love animation. Love it, love it. But it's like I cannot make a living doing this. And so that's when I started trying to head towards live action television, as we would say in the animation business. And then around all of that time is when I met John, and we met and said, we will never work together. We will never be.
Everybody was like, oh, that's so cute. You guys are going to team up. We're like, we're never going to.
No. And then we did.
Yeah. Then we did.
Cause you still had a partner at the time that you meet John, you had a writing partner.
I did. Yeah. One of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, but he was a trust fund, very big trust fund kid who was going to inherit a lot of money. And so I think his drive was to stay alive until he was 33 versus, which was a ways away, versus like, let's really work on these scripts. And, you know, I mean, it's tough. That was one of the hardest, that was a breakup. It felt like like a short marriage that broke up. But
he blamed me. He blamed me all along. I'll tell you what he called me. But it was a John Lennon reference, a Beatles reference of
which is so unfair, because I hate when people bring it up, because it's just not accurate. And she's incredible.
I agree.
What's the first time you do start writing together? And how long had you been a couple when the creative partnership started?
Well, also being a very lucky person, I met Kat within 6 months of moving to LA, and we were already dating.
This is John. It's just waltzing, you know, have everything handed to you.
This is easy, guys. What the heck? Well, I remember we were actually struggling because we were writing separately. We were always working, but it was kids TV. So Kat was doing Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, the TV show, like she was saying. I was working on some Nickelodeon sketch shows, like all that, and the Amanda Show. And we just couldn't, all we wanted to do was write network half hour. Like, and it was the heyday. There were so many jobs and we could not get a job breaking through. And no one took
handing jobs out to people. People walk into Hollywood and they're like, here's a pen, here's some paper, you have a job. You know, meet me on the lot on Tuesday.
Yeah, Roseanne had so many writers, they had to wear numbers on their shirts that we couldn't break in. And so at one point, I think because we would always show each other's scripts and we would give notes. And at one point, Cindy Shupak again had a pilot called Madigan Men. And she flew us out to New York to just help, like to do punch up. And it was a kind of nerve wracking, like, how are we going to be as a married team in a room? Like, you don't know. You know, where you're going to disagree, and then suddenly you're like, well, you invited too many people to the wedding, and then it all helps for exclusion in front of people. And we got in there, and it was actually great. Like, it was, we supported, we kind of played off of each other, and it was sort of that 1 + 1 = 3 kind of thing, which is why Kat's so bad at math, probably, because that's a saying.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, we might want to do this. And then I think some of the writers there kind of encouraged, like, you know, a team, a married male female team, if you can make it work, might be a real selling point. And so I forget exactly the timing of this, but we kind of went back and wrote a couple specs together. And then we were staffed that next season on a network show. So it really did something for us.
And what was that show?
Staffed by a guy that we still are good friends with, and
no, this was Hope and Faith.
That was Hope and Faith. Yeah, that was the next one. Yeah, Hope and Faith that took us to New York. We moved to New York City.
Moved to New York and worked on that with Kelly Ripa, the wonderful Kelly Ripa.
Hey, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin.
Listen, you like podcasts, right? Sure you do. Don't try and lie to me. You're listening to one right now, so why not try a different one? Called R1, The Flophouse.
And on The Flophouse, we watch a movie and talk about it. And then sometimes we also do other stuff.
It's all meant to be funny and fun, and we think you'll have a good time. And just to be clear, the name of the podcast is not R1, The Flophouse. It's just called The Flophouse. I do a lot of correcting Dan.
The Flophouse. A lot of correcting Dan.
And so that would have been, was that around the time when you were starting, when you're thinking about the earliest version of Kings of Ohio? I know you talked about, like, that was before My Name is Earl. Mm-hmm. So
I think it was maybe even, it was, because there was a character we did a Hope and Faith where it was something like where they dinged up, you know, the Ted McGinley's prize car, like Faith Ford and, you know, It was, by the way, it was really confusing because it's Hope and Faith, but Faith Ford played Hope.
Yeah.
It would be endless confusion on set. We're pitching in the room. People would be like, Faith, Hope, you know. But anyway, but it was, and it was, you know, it was a typical sitcom story. Like, we can't let the husband know we dinged up the car. So they go to an auto, like a repair place for a car, a body shop, and they run into two guys that they knew from high school. And the only way these guys will do it is if they, because they wouldn't go to the Hope and Faith wouldn't go to the prom with these guys when they were in high school. So they're like, oh, well, if we go out to, I think it was like Cheesecake Factory together, whatever it is, we'll do this for free. And so they go on a date. But those two guys were Ronnie and Donnie. And Kat and I could not have had more authorship of the role of the kind of hillbilly, kind of central Ohio / Kansas people, because they were friends of ours and we grew up. And I remember we were like, oh my God, I just want to do a show like this with these main characters. Yes, so we started writing that then. It was much darker then, but.
Right. You said you mentioned in the quick interview that it started with a sort of attempted suicide.
Yeah.
It was a guy in his car, basically with the exhaust pipe going into the car slowly, you know, just ready to check out, when his buddy, I don't remember if it was Ronnie or Donnie, came, you know, like pumping in the car, more or less going, hey, so what's going on? What are you doing just sitting here? And I don't know. It started with a suicide. They both passed out in the car, and the car ran, rolled down a hill and into a lake, and it woke them both up, and they survived. And that was the beginning of the pilot.
And that version, I mean, you never, it sounds like you didn't like finish that version of the pilot, or did you actually write that whole thing?
I think we got about halfway through. I mean, we had outlined the whole thing and we knew what it was. And I can't remember if we said this in the sort of pre-interview, but
my name
and
is
then Earl. It was, yeah. And then we read it and it was like, holy crap, that's better than what we're doing. And it's the same voice. And so we just kind of put it down. We were going to, and it was called Mullets, and we were going to, we had Kevin Plunkett, who was like had a comedy at Paramount at the time.
Yeah.
We were going to go out with it with him, just the pitch also. So it was getting a little momentum, and then it was clear, like, this is a waste of time. And then all of our efforts were like, how do we get on My Name is Earl? Like, that just became all we cared about and forgot about it after that.
Yeah.
And you got onto My Name, the first season, My Name is Earl?
Yeah, we started off at the beginning. And that started with, it's like, we were bugging our agents like crazy to get our script to Greg Garcia, who created My Name is Earl. And it was just impossible. It was just impossible. And, you know, trying to get that meeting. And I think it was the day of, he was going to have to fly to New York for upfronts. Was it
the day before upfronts. And we'd heard that he was fully staffed. And there was
zero change.
Yeah, I don't know what our agent did, but he somehow convinced Greg, because he was meeting everybody in town, and he, you know, it was the hot show at that time. And we had actually turned down a job with the off chance that maybe we could get a meeting. I mean, we were that passionate about it. We felt like it spoke to us so much. And so I think that might be how our agent got. It's like, Greg, just meet these guys. They turned a job down. They're not in the level of their career where they should be turning stuff down. And so we got a call. Amy Hartwood called us at like 8 p.m. because she was at 20th at the time, at 8 p.m. like on a Friday night or something, and said, Greg is going to meet with you. This is really exciting, but you got to meet him at his house tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. It was really early because he's about to get on a flight to go to upfronts. And our agent said, you know what, he's met everybody in town, because he was on the call too. He's like, you should probably come in with some story ideas also. And it was probably 7 p.m. We already poured a drink. Kat's friend was visiting and we'd had a martini. And then, Kat's friend was like, I'll take care of cooking food. Don't worry about it. You guys go come up with stories. And so we worked until about 2 a.m. or something, coming up with different.
And then got up at 6 a.m. and did an hour and a half drive to Greg's house and sat and pitched.
And did any of those stories that you pitched him become episodes?
Yeah. It was one of those things in the meeting where what we decided is, instead of just pitching here's an idea, we do this to this day, is we just sort of talk about the show, and it's like, it reminds me of this thing that happened to me. And they were all based on things that happened to us. But one of them, there's an episode that's based on something that I did as a kid that was terrible, where I shot a girl with a BB gun. And there's a whole episode about it that's true of what exactly happened, where I won't get into that. But it's but anyway, so that one became an episode. I think there were two or three that really just hit the nail on the head for Greg.
Yeah.
And then we had to talk Dana into opening the budget to get room for us.
Wow. Yeah. Were there a bunch of other writers on that show who were from, you know, the Midwest, from the area? Yeah. Did he really try and
he did a the show hell of a job? Yeah. Like, I mean, if you think, Kat, it's like everybody had a small town. Like, do you know Vali Chandrasekaran?
Yeah.
So he's from a small town in Pennsylvania. So Hillary Winston is she's from a small town. It's like there's a guy, J.B. Cook, who was, right out of the pages of My Name is Earl. It was a really great staff.
And that's, I mean, so that shows one of the first single camera comedies that, right? I mean, there hadn't been that many, and you were coming at Hope and Faith as a multicam.
Yeah.
So you'd done sort of animation and multicam and sketch. Was that the first show that you were doing, writing that single camera?
Yeah, it was our first single camera. Yeah, and it was, and we loved it. It's like, I think because on multicam, it's got, which we also love, but it's got a very specific rhythm that you've got to hit. You know, it's like, you can't go this long without having a joke. You know, it's just like, there's just a bunch of, and they tend to be, not always, but they just tend to be broader. Although, as I say this, Earl was pretty broad in comedy. But it was grounded in a core of real people. Every one of the characters on My Name is Earl is really based on somebody that Greg Garcia knew, that Hillary Winston knew, that J.B. Cook or us or Danielle Sanchez-Witzel. It's like they were all based on our own small town experiences and those, you know, those sometimes really quirky people. And small towns have such a specific culture. So it's like we all had so much to draw from on there.
I think what we all, I mean, we talked about this in the room is that, and there were a bunch of other writers we're not mentioning, it was a big stuff, but that we wrote this stuff kind of out of love for the people that we all grew up around versus making fun of. And that was always the switch. Like it's like there was a, you know, a sort of a hillbilly wedding, but it was based on someone having gone to their best friend's wedding where there was a Twinkie cake and all this other stuff. And so it was never looking down on those people. And I think that was kind of what made it work.
And so this Kings of Ohio, I know there's so many shows you guys have worked on that I'd love to talk about, but talking about the pilot. So had this idea, you know, always stayed sort of percolating under the surface while you're doing other things? Because I know, you know, it's a long time that it's set aside before you come back to it.
I think so. Can I take walks all the time? Like we'll take like 3-mile walks, you know, and we'll talk. And that's where we do most of our writing thinking in a lot of ways. And we'll talk about characters or like pilots from the past or stuff, almost like they were friends. Sometimes you'll just catch yourself talking about some characters. And I feel like that one just kind of always felt like it was something that was never even got a chance to go out and be rejected.
Yeah. Well, and the people in that, the characters in that are so familiar and real to us because they really are, like the character of Ronnie. Is it Ronnie or Donnie?
It's Ronnie.
Ronnie.
Fast-talking guy. Yeah.
Yeah, the fast-talking. It's like every small town has that guy. Every high school has that, you know, that guy who is, you know, he's always like, well, I can get you this for cheaper, you know, and it's always ends up being a mess. And it's, but it's real and it's a real mess. And I think that was the thing. It's like, because we knew these people and we knew that they were not just caricatures, they're real people with real reasons why they are who they are and like they are because of their upbringing, because of their place, because of, you know, the hard luck version of their area, like small town Ohio. I mean, Ohio now is just, you know, it's become a wasteland, no manufacturing, everything is gone. And so it's like we based that so much on people and places that we knew and some of the real struggles that happened. I mean, with a comic twist to them, but real struggles.
I had a friend named Tommy who was like that, running, like, hey, man, all right, here's what we're going to do. Okay, here's the plan. And it would always, you would see him, like, if you didn't hang out with him on the weekend, you'd see him on Monday and he'd have like a big, like what was like someone hit him in the face with a rake pole or something. Like, all right, what happened this weekend? And there was always something where it's like he got caught up in the barbed wire trying to climb over something, you know, that spiral barbed wire where he kind of got stuck there and the cops showed up. And I guarantee when they did, it was like, what are you doing? It's like, nothing.
Well, then in small town Kansas, it's like there would be the kid who came to school one day missing a finger, you know, because it's like it got caught in the hay baler, you know, and popped off. You know, and maybe they put it back. I know one guy who had his finger was sewn back on. It was this one. And his finger was sewn back on, but it was never quite right. So he was always like flipping you the bird constantly. And he would try to keep that. It's Kansas and you don't want to do that. It's not polite. So he would always try to keep that one kind of in his pocket. But he was right-handed and it was right hand. And so it's like, you know, you got flipped the bird a lot by that guy.
I love how even that, that detail from the script that seems like, okay, well, that's just a, you know, that they're just pushing the comedy, the guy chopping off his pinky, you know, that even that is from a real, you know, friend of yours or person you knew. What year was it that you sold this?
I can't remember. I think it was like 2016, maybe.
I mean, I'm just wondering because I just remember, you know, I think we were both, you know, in deals at overall deals at Disney. Yes. ABC 2016. When I've talked about this on the show, where it seems like Trump's election seemed for the executives to make them aware that there were a bunch of states they had not ever thought about in the middle of the country. Right there. And there's people that watch TV in those states too. And like, we should really be like, you know, there's this weird push to like, we got to, you know, market to these red state people that just, and so I was just wondering if this was in that moment where they were kind of looking for material in this kind of world.
Yeah, it was, you know, I think it kind of was also the casualty of, because we had sold with another writer, Jeremy Hall, an hour long, which we'd never done at that point, that was based on something true that happened to him. But it was like a, you know, it was a ABC Studios for ABC, and we sold the pitch in the room, and it was a put pilot, and they were really excited about it. We've never heard of it because they didn't make it. But because of that, then we wanted to try to get a comedy going, and especially in that climate of like they're looking for red state stuff. And so I think that's when we talked to the studio and we're like, here's what it is. Can we just write this thing and we'll just get it over to ABC? It feels like exactly what they're asking for. And it was one of our best development experiences with like Amy and that guy, Zach Olin, and they were really behind it. They were really excited. You know, they were plussing stuff with notes and it felt like, okay, this is feeling like a good year between this put pilot that's put, it's going to be on the air. I mean, we know.
It's in the title, put pilot.
And then I think what partially happened is what we heard back is that it's, you know, it's like they're really excited about this hour long and they don't want us to have split attention span. So that's kind of the end of it.
Yeah.
So did you write it did you spec it and then take it out or did you pitch it?
Well, I mean, we pitched it to the studio. We were a deal. And so then we just spec'd it there.
Then you spec'd it. So you sold it to... You took the script to the network.
Yeah,
we took the script to the network, and then they also, the studio, after they heard that, wouldn't take it out anywhere else. They're like, that's the end of that. Because the network wants you to focus on the hour long, as they did in deal.
They're not going to make. I'm remembering, like, I think, like, I got sent Hillbilly Elegy from like three different, like, you know, people at that time. That's what I remember. It was just everyone's like wants to make Hillbilly Elegy, and so the development process of this was just really with the studio. And I mean, what I really, you know, and I just listened to the read again, and what I really enjoy about it is the stuff with Brad and Darla is played very much like a drama, you know, like Brad as it all feels very real, like, you know, and it's partly, you know, Garrick Bernard, who played Brad, like, you know, played it very real and understated. And that stuff plays just like, you just feel for a guy who's trying to get his wife back, who's, you know, and then the comedy, so much of it is really, you know, provided by Ronnie and Carl, you know. Yeah. But it never, you know, felt like, oh, we're pushing this to just be a comedy. You know, you allow the drama to really sort of play as drama. And I was just wondering, it seems like a network comedy development process would push you away from some of that and want be more worried, like, oh, this is feeling a little too indie movie. Like, can we, like, you know, make the comedy a little bit bigger? But that, it seems like you didn't really run into any of that.
Well, I'm sure they probably were pushing more and more. And we'd been at ABC Studios, I think, 7 or 8 years at that point. And so I think they're also just like, just let them do their thing. Hopefully they'll buy it. But it, yeah, you know, honestly, it's one of the things that we have run into off and on. And now that we're into features, it's the right voice. I think we might have been feature writers for a long time who just really liked, you know, television. But we've always loved the indie feature feel, and feel like you can do so much. And now it's really happening in streaming. But I feel like that's where we were trying to hit, you know. And I think our argument to the studio was, well, it's like, look, we're from these towns. We know you got to treat what they're treating as serious. Otherwise, it looks like you're ridiculing them. There needs to be a moment at the end where, you know, it makes you really feel something, which was, I feel like we did on Earl, although that was a hilarious like joke machine that show. Right. But yeah, I don't know, it was interesting hearing it because it was more sincere in some of those moments that I think we even remembered.
Yeah Well, and it is interesting because it's like now when you look at streaming and what's on streaming and what's considered a comedy on streaming, that it's a broad genre now. It's much broader than it used to be, which I think is fantastic, because it's like, I think that reality and comedy can go hand in hand. And true emotion and comedy can go hand in hand and play really well against each other. And it's like, honestly, for comedies to be funny, for jokes to be funny, they have to be some level of reality and sincerity behind it, and which is what you need for drama. And so I think I've always thought there's much more crossover there than sometimes the narrow categories. And streaming has changed a lot of that. You know, it's like John and I have been watching, I keep calling it the Big Blue.
Oh, the Big Door Prize.
Big Door Prize. And that, it's like, I would call that a comedy, and I would also call it a dramedy, you know, and then we might call that, you know, it's a space that's available now that when that really wasn't as available around the time of my
what life. You're trying to say is we were trailblazers in our field.
Yes. Yes, that's it, exactly. We were ahead of the curve.
Honestly, we've always just been wishing we could write like a Richard Linklater movie, I think, deep down inside.
It's something that, the network comedy departments are not looking for that.
They're not at all. You know what's a shame, too, is we have these skills. We were talking to Kevin Plunkett not long ago, and we were telling him some life experience, and he was like, that's a show. That's a broadcast multi-camera. He's like, just go sell that. He's like, and don't add music to it. Don't add like some kind of like, don't make it animated. He's like, you guys always want to add that extra thing instead of just make a straightforward multi-cam. And we sat down to try to do it, and it's like, it doesn't interest us for some reason. And we know how to do it, but it's just like, we want to do the weird puppet musical or, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know why.
No, I understand. You know, I get this close. I'm just like, you know how to write multicamera. You know, every now and then they're like, they're looking for multicams. Why don't you just toss off a multicam? It's just like, it doesn't interest me. I can't do it. Like, I just don't. God, that's, you know, so yeah, you guys sent me that Henson,
the felt bags.
Which I don't know if we'll ever be able to do. Will you just say what that shows? Because it's really, I'd love to do it. It's such a challenging, you know, production, but
you know, we know
people what the felt bags was.
I'd be curious because Johnny, okay, what's his name? Johnny Tartaglia was attached to this thing, and he's the puppeteer who played like the main role in Avenue Q, and he's like an in-house, you know. It was such a fun collaboration, but the whole idea was that there was like an uprising in like this small Eastern European country of like Puppetstan or something, and which was filled with puppets, and then I think the Russians came in and like put it down violently, and all of these, there were a bunch of refugee puppets that came to America, but then when they showed up on our shores, people didn't know what to do with them, and they also had this issue with the puppets, and that the puppets would this sounds so insane, when they express their emotions, they do it in song, but it's in musical numbers that human beings can't help but join in on. So it's like if you're on your way to work, yeah, you might get caught up in a big musical number on and like downtown, and now you're late because of it. And so yeah, it's then that I guess the government put them in these camps until they could figure out what to do, and then the Supreme Court ruled you can't keep the puppets in camp, and so the show starts where the puppets have been allowed to join American society. And so it's following one family who are the first puppet family to move into a blue collar street in Pittsburgh.
And they're called the felt bags.
The felt bags. And it was going to have the first puppet human pregnancy scare of in recorded history.
Which Henson was, it's like, God bless Henson. They were very into it. And, you know, Johnny Tartaglia was our puppeteer. And it's like when we were pitching it, you know, going around during the rounds of pitching, it's like we had one musical number that was completely written. Alan Menken and Glenn Slater. Glenn is the lyricist. Alan Menken did the music for us. And they wrote this amazing song, like intro song. And so we would go in with Henson and the puppets. Like we would walk in the door and people would go,
"For a show.
Puppets, oh my God." It's like somebody came and kissed one of the puppets and went, "I love you." And, you know, it was so fun and heartwarming, all of it. And if I do say so, the show was actually really funny, but also, you know, also heartwarming and, you know, and dealing with real experiences in a very funny way of immigration. And it was a chance where all of us could talk about our immigration stories, you know, because, you know, 99.9% of us are immigrants here, you know.
I think we'll probably try to go out with it again, I think, at some point. The immigration thing was right at the time was getting so ugly with like Trump was putting kids in cages and all.
Yeah.
Just it's, you know, it wasn't.
And that's really what.
Yeah, now that it's all been solved, it might be a great time for you
that's
guys
true.
To take yeah, that really. Out. That yeah. problem has been fixed.
We don't follow the news, but I'm glad to hear that.
I'll bet it's 100% better now than it was during those days.
I think it would be fun to try to do that. I don't know how, but it would probably cost as much as the whole presentation pilot cost.
But. To do it for Ted Pilots. I mean, it really is. It's so great. I mean, you know, just this puppet musical about the immigration crisis, and like, it's a great script. We just, you know, someday we'll, you know, there were just a few things. We've done musical episodes in the past, but it's just like, okay, it's just music, you know, like, you know, and some of those were like the songs were covers. People, you know, we did this. Yeah. That was basically Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, but it was before that. It was the same kind of concept. So it was like, okay, we can get people who can sing existing songs. But this was like, the songs aren't written. Yeah. You need the puppets. Yeah. You need, you know.
You can only get Alan Menken to write one
song. Yeah, Alan Menken to, you know, if he can score the whole thing, then, you know.
Yeah, he got busy. Yeah, but I think that's another example. We'd love to do the, I don't know, the odd thing. I mean, we got so lucky at ABC where Paul Lee and Sami Falvey started to think of us as like, oh, Cat and John are good with the weird stuff. So we kept getting put on the unusual. And Paul every year would pick up something really odd. God bless him. But we got to work on The Neighbors while we were at ABC. And I remember we were just put on as second in command because this Dan Fogelman guy hadn't run a show before, and they were really concerned.
They were worried.
And so if people don't remember, The Neighbors was about aliens. And I mean, people may not remember what The Neighbors was. So
an alien family who lived in the suburbs, one of those built up subdivisions, gated community.
Oh, it was a New Jersey family that moved into a subdivision that had been bought out of aliens pretending to be humans.
And this was Dan Fogelman's first show, right? First,
I think so. He might have done something back before Cars, like a pilot. I think he did.
Yeah.
What it was called. And so it was great because he was coming off of Crazy Stupid Love and Tangled and all this other stuff, and so he was protected. And he's like, I don't do outlines. and I remember we got a call from ABC, and they're like, Dan just turned in a script. We didn't even see an outline or a story area. And so we were on the phone and Dan was like, yeah, I'm sorry, I just don't do outlines. It's like, I already have the script. What's the point? Should I go write an outline about that script? moving forward, he's like, it's just not how I work. And it was unbelievable because it was almost like he was talking about the weather changing that he had no control over. Cause he was like, guys, I'm sorry. I know it sucks. I just don't do them. And I think it's because he runs such a good show and he is so decisive and the table reads are always hilariously funny that everyone just got comfortable with that show, which we thought now we've got the touch of Dan when we took over Gallivant season two. And turns out Dan has a special not do outlines. Cat and John need to do outlines.
Yeah.
So you did those two shows with him and then you've been doing another show with Dan recently, right? Is that the
I came in to help him. I'm an EP with him on this untitled Dan Fogelman project that we're not supposed to say what it's about, but okay. Sterling K. Brown is the lead. It's really cool. It's a drama, and it's got that Fogelman magic dust of This Is Us kind of vibe, but in a very different way. So I'm actually really excited about it.
Yeah, and you've done a couple shows with Victor Fresco too, right? I mean, there's some people that you guys have worked with.
Yeah, we did.
Victor is great. I think Victor is. It's so fun when you work with another creative person who you just mesh with. It's like we meshed one way with Greg Garcia, kind of over our kind of shared backgrounds in a way, sort of a point of view of the world. And Victor is so incredibly talented and just has this slightly off-kilter take on the world that is amazing that somehow we also really connect with. So it's like he's such a fun guy to work with.
He feels like someone who was really waiting for the streaming thing to happen. You know, the shows he was doing, Better Off Ted, just feels like, okay, that was just, had been made in a streaming universe, people would have understood it better. It just was not a network comedy.
He truly was a trailblazer. Andy Richter controls the universe. Is genius.
Brilliant. Yeah,
that was the show we wanted to be on. That show so bad, and we weren't. We got to work with Victor on his show after that. It was kind of short lived.
We worked together on Earl, so that's when we got to know each other.
And then we did this other one. But anyway, so then when Better Off Ted was there, it was like we felt like we got a chance to work on Andy Richter because there's just that Victor Fresco vibe and kind of did, that was so much fun.
Is there anything, you've done so many different genres and things. Kat, you said you're now writing a book.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, is there something you haven't gotten, a genre, a type of project you've used.
We were talking to Marvel before this Dan thing, and that or the Star Wars world,
yeah, I
think we'd be really into.
It was a little dancing around the edges of that until the Dan project came out.
But
I think would have been really, that would be something that'd be really fun. That when John is done with Dan, I think we would go do that. I'm intending to get my book published, and then we're going to turn that into a streaming series. So we have that in our back pocket.
But I think we're kind of game. We I think we're hitting the our golden years. We're more and more interested in we're doing a stage musical right now. And we've got a producer for it, and we're kind of, you know, it's like we're in the process of that, which means in 8 years it'll be on stage. But I think we're trying to just we're chasing our new experiences, and we really like collaboration. It's one of the reasons we loved working on a musical, because you're collaborating with someone who thinks differently, like with musicians. Working with these puppeteers was really exciting because they think differently, and you got to kind of figure out how to work together. And then working with the animators at Pixar was really cool. And I think we're just sort of wanting to just do new stuff. We had an opportunity, like when we were leaving ABC, we were kind of checking out the landscape. Like, what do we want to do next? We had a friend who was one of the actors from Galavant we saw in London, and she drunkenly was just like, you need to get out, leave ABC. She was like, you need to do
leave network television.
Yeah. He's like, you need to do new stuff. Cause we'd always tell her stuff that we were passionate about that maybe wasn't appropriate for network television. And I feel like that we really listened to that. And then we were looking around like, what's out there. And it was all legit stuff, but it felt like a lot of the same versus we'd been so lucky with Paul Lee picking up a crazy thing every year that we could be a part of, that it didn't feel like that was something that we wanted to do anymore. So, but I think that's what we're chasing.
Yeah. Well, I was going to be excited to see what you guys come up with. I'm glad I finally got you. You know, I loved hearing this. I do think it's just, you know, it's obviously it's really funny. You know, Ronnie and Carl are just such great characters, but it's just, you know, mostly just such a sweet, you know, heartfelt show about real people. And it would have been, you know, I think you know, in a pilot to get us to care about that relationship, you know, you instantly care about the guys. That's not so hard. You know, male friendship of that kind, you know, those are lovable. That's a lovable comedy threesome. But yeah. Just, you know, with Brad and Darla, that you really just see, okay, you know, this is a real relationship. They've got a kid. They've got a dog. You know, you want them to work it out. You see why it's going to be tough.
I think a lot of what we're drawn to, I mean, not surprisingly, but it's like a romantic story or just kind of what makes a relationship work. And like where you see a relationship, in that case, you're seeing a relationship that really should work, but you get the idea that like she's at the end of a rope because all he's doing is trying to protect these idiots, but he can't just leave them to fend for themselves. And so I think we're often drawn to that. Like, what is that relationship? Because relationships are complicated, you know? And I think maybe we're working out our own shit. Characters on
stage. Well, yeah. It is also incredible that you've managed to keep both the creative partnership and marriage going for this long.
24 years.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you know, so few writing teams last that long, you know? It's yeah. Super rare.
Well, now we're into
a good time to announce our big news.
This is when Kat divorces me right here.
Yeah. I haven't told John yet, but you know.
But I appreciate you keeping it just at, you know, boost our ratings. Yeah, that yeah. That right, you saved it. You saved people it for the very end, for the people that listen to the very end. Well, I just hope that never happens. And good luck with the goats and the 14 children. And the movie, yeah. Everyone go see Elemental. It's coming good. Soon. Thanks so much, you guys.
All right.
Thank you. Right. Fun to talk to you.
You too. All right. I hope you enjoyed that. I really did. I love getting to know these two a bit better. Thank you to Kat and John. Dead Pilot Society is produced by me and my co-producer Ben Blacker and our associate producer Noah Findling. It is edited and mixed by Jordan Katz. Leave us a review, tell your friends, follow us on social media, do all those things. And until next time, I'm Andrew Reich. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on the picket lines.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.